Here he comes.
The tiny microphone, fastened under MacArthur's lapel, was sensitive enough to catch a whisper from a range of 6 or 7 feet. The cordless earpiece had begun life as a standard hearing aid, revamped at Stony Man to serve as a receiver with a 1 mile active radius.
I read you.
The Rolls-Royce was a tank designed with luxury in mind. However Sergio Barbosa felt about security, he didn't skimp on dollars where his private comfort was concerned. They'd require statistics from the factory for any kind of detailed rundown, but MacArthur guessed the Rolls would glide through 50 caliber and maybe even 20 millimeter rounds without a hitch. If they were forced to stop Barbosa on the road, some kind of anti-armor round or high explosives would be called for.
Coming your way, cats.
Understood.
MacArthur was crouched beside a motorbike across the street from Sergio Barbosa's office building, juggling wrenches while he waited for the dealer to appear. Katz had the stakeout on the east, with Manning on the west, prepared to trail Barbosa any way it played. The key was versatility and timing, nothing to upset their man or tip his driver off that anyone was shadowing the Rolls. Manning breezed past him in a compact rental, giving Katz and the Rolls a respectable lead.
Yeah.
MacArthur kicked the bike to life and swung around to follow in his own good time, resisting any urge he felt to rush it and produce a pileup on the limo's tail. For now, Barbosa was a lead and nothing more. They had his major operation spotted from the briefing back at Stony Man, but it remained for them to get a feeling for the man. If all they had to do was take him down, a simple visit to his office would have done the trick. Instead, it was a game of watch and wait, at least for now. They were coordinating moves with Bolin and Grimaldi, more or less, to synchronize the play. When they had checked out Barbosa and done the same to his competitor, Velasquez, they'd be prepared to strike. Meanwhile, the executioner would be securing the necessary information for coordinated moves against the government officials who permitted cocaine traffic through the capital of Panama. If they could bring it all together, it would be a triple play, clean sweep. From the direction they were traveling, he knew Barbosa must be headed for his supper club. And from the supper club, if Stony Man's prediction held, they'd be following Barbosa to a nightclub where he ran a small but plush casino in the back, remaining long enough to check out the action to see if there were any women that he fancied on the premises. From there, it could begin to come unglued. He thought about the ruling government's cocaine connections, wondering what kind of opposition they should look for when it hit the fan. Removing one man from the presidential palace hadn't cleaned the slate in Panama by any means. And if Brignola's briefing was an indication of the total picture, they were bound to ruffle some important feathers when they put the ball in play, which fazed MacArthur not at all. If there was heat to come, so be it. He was ready for the worst his enemies could do. The sooner the better, in fact. A clean sweep started with a single stroke, and he could feel it coming any time now. They were on their way.
Pedro Point, Jamaica, Tuesday, 6:15 p.m.
Andrew Morant had driven James and Enciso 20 miles beyond Montego Bay. From what James could determine, the taxi was meant to sound old and busted down, an auditory complement to its appearance, rusty patches like psoriasis with primer gray applied too late, which validated the impression of a junker going nowhere fast. If Calvin had to make an educated guess, he'd have said that the Rasta's taxi had sufficient power underneath the hood to blow most standard-issue squad cars off the highway in Jamaica, maybe even in the States. The rust and primer paint were ugly, as intended, but the bodywork was sound, the bumpers reinforced for ramming in a crunch. There was a pistol hanging underneath the dash, though James couldn't be sure about the make and model. If Morant made any unexpected moves in that direction, James was prepared to punch the man's ticket from his place behind the driver's seat, when a simple clutch and twist would do the job just fine. Their destination was an isolated house, well screened by trees and separated from the coastal highway by 100 yards of tangled undergrowth. Its giant picture windows faced off the cliff's edge, and a blue expanse of water stretched to the far horizon.
Cuba over there, but you can't see him, no. Be 90 miles about there to the nearest point of land. I have the maps and charts you need. Compass, climbing gear, all kinds of things.
Well, then let's check it out.
Sure thing, man.
They could easily have flown into Guantanamo and thus eliminated the necessity of crossing open water, but the risks outweighed the rewards. The U.S. naval station was observed around the clock by Castro's DSE, and slipping out unseen would be a virtual impossibility. And once the Cubans got a fix on them, they were as good as dead. Morant led the way to some steps leading down to a basement carved out of the rock. There was a rugged path from the top of the steps to the beach, 100 feet below. Inside the basement, bright fluorescent lights showed off a combination storage area and workshop where their gear had been collected. Morant pointed to a crate that held a 15-foot inflatable.
This one, she be hard to find on radar. Get where you're going. You can hide her out somewhere or slit her up the belly with a knife. She sink real fine.
The outboard motor was a compact model with a special cowling to reduce its noise. In spite of the precaution, James knew, they'd be rowing for the final mile or so.
What else?
The goods be over here.
Morant moved toward a workbench where two stacks of peasant trousers, shirts, and sandals were arranged. Each pile was anchored with a faded duffel bag. Inside each bag, they found a PA-3DM 9mm submachine gun made in Argentina, plus an Argentinian copy of the Browning high-power automatic pistol and extra magazines for both. A pair of folding knives and plastic bags with their forged ID inside completed the ensemble. James found his partner watching him, a strange expression on his face, as if expecting the ex-SEAL to renege.
Well?
It works. What the hell? We've done with less. Let's get it on.
Paradise Island, Nassau, 6:40 p.m.
The casino was doing fair business when Lyons arrived. He spent a moment at the cashier's cage and turned $5,000 into chips before he started trolling, making his way toward the baccarat tables. It was a Vegas layout with a Monte Carlo crowd. No faded jeans or loud Hawaiian shirts to mark the tourists. Tuxedos and formal evening gowns were the rule, presenting the image, however erroneous, of a high-quality, upscale crowd. In fact, the dress code seemed to modify behavior, toning down the raucous laughter that was normally a fixture of the carpet joints in Vegas or Atlantic City. These gamblers had come to risk their money, the same as anywhere else, but they meant to do it with style. It was ironic considering the origins of the Paradise Island Casino. Meyer Lansky and the Mafia had done the groundwork a quarter century earlier, trying to recoup their losses after Castro closed the mob's casinos in Havana. Lansky's brainchild was an innocuous-sounding construction company called Mary Carter Limited, designed to lull suspicious locals while their legislators were seduced with bribes. By 1967, Lansky and his pals were raking in the skim and cashing in on liberal Bahamian banking laws. For ranking leaders of the syndicate, the islands were a profitable hybrid of Hawaii, Switzerland, and Vegas, all rolled into one. Lyons spotted his man at the second baccarat table, gold-rimmed glasses bright against his ebony skin. The tux that Thomas Mensur wore had set him back an easy grand, but from the pile of chips in front of him, it looked like he was doing well enough to buy the tailor out.
Hi, room for one more?
Yes, sir. Please wait until this hand is over.
You can take my place, son. I'm getting hosed here.
Nine.
Player?
Damn it. You see?
Thanks.
Next hand, the shoe passes to you.
Thank you.
Place your bets.
Lyons picked up his cards and glanced at them, seeing a queen of spades and nine of hearts.
Natural.
Oh, shit. I knew I shouldn't have left.
It's all about timing, pal.
Bets?
I'll bet $2,000 on player.
$2,000 banker.
I'll match that. $2,000 player.
Lyons held a jack of hearts and two of clubs. Face cards meant zero, giving him two, where nine was ideal.
How would you like to proceed?
I'll take a third card.
Eight of clubs.
I'm at zero. Had a good start.
Mensur won the next two hands with an eight and a natural nine, respectively. He was a man who liked to win from all appearances. A thousand candle power smile turned on each time the sweet cards came his way. The pile of colored chips in front of him had taken on the likeness of a child's toy fortress, towers rising on either side. The shoe was running low, and everybody took a break while six new decks were shuffled, then slotted into place.
Well, I think that's my cue to step out.
Had enough excitement for one evening?
Of this kind.
The Englishwoman leaned in close to Lyons.
But I'll stay and watch you. if you promise to beat that cad over there.
I'll do what I can.
Play your cards right, and you could be very lucky.
The shoe was then passed to Menser, bringing on another smile. No way for him to cheat in these surroundings, but the man had confidence enough for half a dozen gamblers as it was. Lyons made a point of meeting Menser's gaze this time around, a hint of challenge in his eyes.
Place your bet, sir.
The able team leader looked at his cards. 4 and a 3, totaling 7. He decided it wouldn't hurt to test his luck.
Again.
2 of clubs.
9.
Menser's smile lost wattage. The next 4 hands were split right down the middle, 2 for Lyons, 2 for Menser. Menser had a clear-cut lead as far as money was concerned, with some $40,000 stacked in front of him. He could afford to take a chance when the able team leader was forced to be conservative, but Lyons knew that he'd have to play with cast-iron nerve if he had any hope of pulling off a sweep, beginning now.
Bets?
$4,000 on player.
Feeling lucky.
You could say that.
$5,000, banker.
He caught a 4 of diamonds and a 3 of hearts to make it 7. All the rule book said that he should stand and hope the dealer busted out.
Another.
4 of clubs.
Lyons fought to keep himself from grimacing. His 3 cards added up to 1. A deuce would beat him now if the dealer didn't blow it.
I'll take another card.
Damn it.
6 of spades on banker's 4. Player?
The money came to Lyons, and he felt a new rush of adrenaline kick in. His adversary let him have a natural the next time out, a 9 to Menser's 8, and Lyons closed the gap to 14 grand between them. Menser's smile was history, his full attention focused on the cards and his opponent's face. Whatever he was seeing there, Lyons hoped it left him ill at ease. The next round went to Menser, beating Lyons's 7 with another 8, but the enjoyment had begun to pale. The dealer lighted a cigarette and left it burning in the ashtray, instantly forgotten as he started thumbing more cards from the shoe. A 6 and a deuce to Lyons for a solid 8. The dealer played it safe and stood on 7, losing 2 grand for his trouble. When he tried to make it back by doubling his bet next time around, the queen and 9 of hearts that Lyons held defeated him. 10 grand between them now, and Lyons knew it was time to make his move. Another hand or 2 could do it, if he kept his nerve and played with skill. No time like the present. Menser dealt him a 5 of diamonds and the 8 of spades. With 6 in hand, the game could still go either way, but Lyons had a feeling now. It wasn't luck or even confidence so much as a conviction that the game was his. He made a show of counting chips, frowning to himself with mock concentration before he pushed 25,000 across the green field. Menser blinked once in surprise.
Excuse me, sir. Would you consent to waive the table limit in this case?
Menser began to shovel chips across. No fortress now. The pile of plastic wafers suddenly reminded Lyons of a model city gone to ruin in the wake of World War III.
Your play, sir?
Another card.
3 of diamonds.
That makes for 9.
It.
I think we're good here.
I agree. And if you'd like to keep winning, darling, I'm in the Grand Islands Hotel, room 317.
Thank you. Croupier.
Yes, sir?
See if you can get security to bag my winnings.
Of course, sir.
And here's something for you.
Thank you, sir.
As the croupier leaned over to pick up the $500 chip, half a dozen strangers were gathered around to shake Lyons' hand, hoping some of his luck rubbed off on contact. He was feeling like a candidate for city council when a black hand wrapped around his own.
Congratulations. You play courageously.
I do my best. Chad Lewis from Chicago.
Thomas Menser. May I ask if you are here on holiday or business?
Some of each. I deal in pharmaceuticals around the Midwest region. Rumor has it the Bahamas are the place to be for major deals.
With all the manufacturers you have in the United States?
They don't turn out the merchandise I need.
Ah.
Thing is, it's not that easy making contact.
But there's a possibility that I can help you there.
You think so?
Oh, I'm convinced of it.
In that case, let me buy you a drink.
Panama City, 6:50 p.m.
The key to rattling an enemy, Bolin figured, was to find his weakest point and hammer it relentlessly until you had a breakthrough. In the present circumstances, he assessed the common weakness of his adversaries as their competition, breeding paranoia, and a passion for security. If he could plant a wedge between the city's major dealers, drive it deep enough, they just might turn on one another and proceed to do a measure of the soldier's work. If nothing else, it was a chance for him to thin the ranks. He flipped a mental coin, deciding he'd start with Sergio Barbosa. The dealer made his home in Balboa Heights, north of Panama City. But his business headquarters occupied the top floor of an office building near the waterfront, symbolically watching over the port where much of his merchandise entered the country. Considering the Latin trend toward a siesta in the afternoon and dining late, it came as no surprise to find Barbosa's office occupied in early evening. Bolin had no way of knowing if Barbosa would be there in person, and it made no difference. For the moment, it was adequate to know that he'd get the message one way or another. Something for the smuggler to think about while Bolin cinched the noose around his neck. He wore a set of workman's overalls emblazoned with the logo of a non-existent plumbing company. He carried a 3-foot toolbox as he walked on the rooftop opposite Barbosa's office. Underneath a tray of drill bits and screwdrivers lay a Walther WA-2000 sniper rifle. The German rifle was unique in both appearance and design. A bullpup model with its 6-round magazine behind the pistol grip, it had a fluted 26-inch barrel clamped at either end to minimize the loss of accuracy when a shot was fired. Recoil was further reduced by the weapon's semi-automatic action and a heavy muzzle brake. The Walther was chambered for 300 Winchester Magnum rounds, and its standard telescopic sight from Schmidt and Bender offered a 10-power zoom, which was more than adequate for Bolin's present needs. With the supporting bipod bolted into place, he had a sturdy, compact killer in his hands. A quick scan of the lighted office windows showed him 6 men on the job, no women visible at any point. Barbosa's machismo was showing, to Bolin's relief, eliminating any need for him to pick and choose. Another sweep confirmed that Sergio wasn't among them, and he settled on a squat hard man near the window, riffling through the contents of a filing cabinet. Bolin's sniper scope picked out the bulge of hardware underneath his target's coat before the crosshair settled on a pockmarked cheek. The warrior took a deep breath, let part of it go, and held the rest. He was across the street and only 2 floors above his target. There would be no correction necessary for the bullet's rise or drop. Bolin watched the silver-tipped Super X round drill through the glass and rip into his target's face. The executioner swiveled to the right a few degrees and caught a second member of the team still gaping at his dead companion, trying to make sense of what he saw. Bolin watched the gunman's lower jaw disintegrate, explosive impact punching him backward in his swivel chair. The 4 survivors knew they were in trouble now, but there was still initial shock to overcome, a natural confusion as their comrades fell among them. 2 of them dropped instinctively and scrambled under nearby desks, reactions typical of soldiers with experience. The other 2 were green, one of them actually reaching for a pistol on his belt. The window finally shattered, and the quick-draw artist's white shirt turned red. He was slammed against the nearest wall, hanging there for perhaps a second and a half before surrendering to gravity. 3 down, and 3 rounds still remaining in the Walther's magazine. The only gunner still remaining on his feet had reconsidered his decision, ducking toward a bank of filing cabinets with his shoulders hunched, head down. Bolin helped him get there. The other men were safely out of sight and not coming out anytime soon. Bolin used his last 2 rounds on target practice. The office water cooler was now a fountain, and the wall clock turned into an expressionist's masterpiece. He packed the Walther, left the scattered brass behind, and headed for the waiting elevator. It would take a few more moments for the 2 survivors to recover and alert police, but anyone who heard the shots could place a call, and Bolin knew that he was running out of time. Barbosa would receive the message, but he wouldn't understand at first. The dealer would begin to cast around for enemies, and he wouldn't have far to look. Within the next few hours, Bolin hoped there would be enemies enough to go around for all concerned.
Stonyman Farm, Wednesday, 5:30 a.m.
It would be the best part of an hour before the sun lighted up Virginia's Blue Ridge Mountains, but Aaron Kurtzman was awake and on the job. His console in the Stony Man computer room was fashioned in the aspect of a giant horseshoe, with a master keyboard and auxiliaries, four monitors, a laser printer, and a battery of telephones. The room itself was something from a hacker's high-tech fantasy, with sophisticated hardware online to the Pentagon, Langley, the Justice Department, and a satellite surveillance network that could count the trees in someone's backyard. This morning, though, Kurtzman's thoughts were far removed from any problems in the Eastern Hemisphere. The troops were working relatively close to home, but their proximity didn't mean they were safe by any means. The battle had been joined, on one front anyway, and Kurtzman hated knowing there was nothing he could do but watch and wait.
Hey, Bear. You're up early.
No, I'm up late. And judging from those bags under your eyes, so are you.
You got it. What's happening?
It's quiet at the moment, but they had a busy night. Five hits against Barbosa and Velasquez that I'm sure of. Close to 20 hostiles down. The locals think they have a gang war on their hands.
They will, before he's finished.
Kurtzman nodded, recognizing Boland's plan. It was divide and conquer all the way, made easier by the suspicion that prevailed between Barbosa and Velasquez in their world of subterfuge and double-cross. It didn't take much agitation to provoke a fight between two jackals, and the executioner was skilled at rattling his enemies. With any luck at all, the dealers might dispose of each other, or at least reduce the odds by thinning out the ranks. Whatever else went down in Panama in the next 2 days or so, the local cops and coroner would have their hands full counting bodies, trying to control a situation they'd never fully understand.
How's Abel doing?
Contact with a money man. It's early yet for any kind of deal, but they'll be pushing. Lyons doesn't like to wait around.
I wish we had a better fix on Mincer's contacts. He has to have an in with the police. The way it is, we're damn near working blind.
Now, their contact from the DEA should have a line on that end of the game. He's got enough time in to know the players on a first-name basis.
Still no comeback on Miami?
Escalante wasn't anybody's favorite citizen. They aren't exactly lighting candles down at Metro Dade, and DEA's been falling on his operation like a ton of bricks. Whoever's taking Escalante's place will have a hard time moving any merchandise the next few days.
And if they catch a break?
Those few days could be enough to shut the pipeline down.
Right. Well, one pipeline anyway.
No lasting victories, but what the hell?
That just leaves Raphael and Calvin.
En route. They should be landing any time within the next half hour, but we can't depend on any contact after that until they wrap it up.
And Cuba was potentially the joker in the deck, he realized. At least in Panama and the Bahamas, their respective governments were still on speaking terms. The very act of penetrating Cuban territory raised the kind of diplomatic questions Washington would rather sidestep and ignore. It was essentially an act of war, and while precautions had been taken to reduce the risk of any demonstrated link to the United States, Kurtzman's primary concern lay with James and Enciso. They could easily be lost without a trace in Cuba, and pursuing them would be a no-win proposition all around.
How solid are their contacts on the island?
According to the company, they're granite. Of course, the company was certain everybody in Cuba would revolt against Fidel and kick his ass in 61 when they set up the Bay of Pigs.
I like your confidence.
Truth is, the information network in Havana is about the best thing that Langley has. I mean, they've had the net in place for over 30 years. They're working on a second generation of devoted spooks. I think we'll be all right.
I'm sure we will. It's Raphael and Calvin I'm concerned about.
Well, they'll make it.
But even as he spoke, he wondered whether he was reassuring Barbara or himself.
Cabo Cruz, Cuba. 5:50 a.m.
They had begun their run at 10:30, and they were pushing daylight even so. On solid ground, with any kind of decent vehicle, they could have made the transit in an hour and a half, no sweat. This was different. Traveling by night on open water, navigating by the stars, and stopping twice to fill the outboard engine's tank with gasoline, they managed barely 18 miles per hour for the trip. The last mile and a half without the engine had been even slower, rowing toward the darkened coastline, constantly alerted to any sound of engines that would mean a communist patrol. Enciso had to trust the fact that they were underneath the coastal radar. Otherwise, there should have been patrol boats masted and waiting for them, many helicopters in the air. The Fidelistas were as conscious of security as the Israelis, moving swiftly when perimeters were breached and uninvited visitors set foot on Cuban soil. Those visitors were prone to disappear without a trace, Enciso knew, though some of them were kept alive for propaganda purposes. a captured agent now and then, whose presence on the island could embarrass Washington sufficiently to satisfy Fidel's colossal ego, make him think he was one up in the game of national diplomacy. These days, the satisfaction of a nuisance victory from time to time was all that Castro had. It was incredible the way the man hung on in spite of everything that happened in the world around him. In the recent past, communism had been repudiated by Moscow and the nations of Eastern Europe. Germany was reunited, with the Berlin Wall reduced to scrap and chunk souvenirs for Western tourists. Hungary's dictator had been executed by firing squad, and Russian moderates had defeated a short-lived coup attempt by hardline Reds. Still, for all the worldwide changes, Castro's Cuba seemed to exist in a political vacuum, divorced from the reality of international events. Gray hair aside, he might have been the same Fidel who tried to bluff America with Russian missiles decades ago. Imprisonment of dissidents was still the rule, with cruel interrogation teams and firing squads still gainfully employed at the Principe prison in Havana. Censorship remained a fact of life, and government reports proclaimed that Castro still enjoyed a widespread popularity among his people. But the truth was difficult, if not impossible, to judge. This morning, with the pre-dawn darkness giving way to a faint light in the east, Enciso dared not let himself be sidetracked by the broader cause of Cuba Libre. He was pledged to a specific mission, with precise and limited objectives, in and out, if everything went well. Someone had written that you can't go home again. Of course, it wasn't literally true, but Rafael Enciso understood the sentiment. Your life, the lives of those around you, changed irrevocably each and every day. Once years had passed, returning to your roots became an exercise in preordained futility. And yet, some men were bound to try, against the odds, determined to reverse the course of history. Enciso had decided it was one thing to repay old scores and punish enemies, another to expect that what you did for private motives would eventually change the world. In joining Phoenix Force, he had accepted and acknowledged his responsibility to stand against the savages in any form, forsaking private grudges for the most part, working for a common cause. But if the two should intersect...
Move, move, move!
There was a flooded cavern close to where they landed, carved out of the cliff by several million years of wind and water working constantly on polished stone. They carried the inflatable inside and weighted it with stones against the possibility they might be able to return and use it for their getaway. And if it blew up in their faces, they'd have to find another way, assuming they were still in any shape to leave the island once their work was done. Once safely stored away, James and Enciso retreated into the nearby rocks where they had left their duffel bags.
That's it. You ready?
It was a long walk to Nicaro, where their contact would be waiting, but discretion was the better part of valor, and they had specifically requested that they not be met. In fact, the man they were supposed to meet had no idea of how or where they would be entering the country. Just in case.
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
And he hoped that it was true.
Panama City, 6:15 a.m.
It was early for the jackals to be stirring, but in Boland's estimation, they had passed a restless night. Before he broke off contact, shortly after 2 o'clock, he had allowed both major gangs to feel the heat, a switch-off that would make Barbosa and Velasquez realize that both of them were under fire. All things considered, with the atmosphere of competition they had cultivated during recent months, the logical result would be suspicion aimed at each other, hopefully igniting sparks that could be fanned into a full-fledged shooting war. In fact, he was prepared to fan some sparks right now. The shipping office was Velasquez's pride and joy, a point of entry for approximately half of the cocaine he moved through Panama and the Bahamas and Miami. Other shipments traveled overland or came by air, diverse routes utilized to frustrate customs and the DEA, but ocean-going traffic from the east coast of Colombia to Panama was fairly constant, with official payoffs minimizing interference from the law. So far, the information Boland had received from Angelo Rodriguez and Miranda had been accurate in all respects, but he reviewed each target in advance, allowing for the possibility of error or deliberate deception. He had no reason to mistrust the dissidents as yet, but he had seen how personal agendas sometimes skewed perception and produced erroneous reports. The last thing Boland needed was to find himself caught up in any kind of local power play. According to the intelligence, Velasquez was expecting, or had just received, a major shipment at his warehouse on the waterfront. For Bolin's purposes, it hardly mattered either way. If he could torch a load of coke, so much the better. But his goal was simple havoc, come what may. He wore a knee-length overcoat that covered up his hardware, a Beretta 92SB autoloader slung beneath his left arm in a quick-draw rig, and the stubby Heckler & Koch MP5K submachine gun carried on a swivel mount to Bolin's right. The outer pockets of his coat were heavy with M68 impact fragmentation grenades and spare magazines for the H&K stutter gun. The warrior believed in preparing himself, leaving little or nothing to chance. Gray dawn was breaking on the waterfront as Bolin left his vehicle and walked the long block to his target. Even with the night's turmoil, there were no guards posted in the warehouse parking lot or on the loading dock. Velasquez was apparently intent on broadcasting the image of business as usual, biding his time until he could identify his enemies and move decisively to mete out punishment. Meanwhile, the executioner had no doubt that there would be guards inside the building, but the absence of perimeter defenses gave him room to operate. A metal ladder had been bolted to the warehouse wall beside the loading dock, and Bolin took advantage of it. The executioner looked over the broad, flat roof. Skylights had been employed to save on electricity, and the warrior used them now to scan the indoor killing ground as best he could. Below him, crates and cartons were arranged in east-west rows, with aisles between them, forklifts standing off to one side like a pair of drowsy dinosaurs. He couldn't see the office, but he counted four armed men and doubled that to play it safe. He stared at the west end of the warehouse, farthest from the ladder, with a frag grenade in one hand and his MP5K submachine gun in the other. Four skylights, four grenades. He dropped his grenade in the newly made hole, racing on toward the next skylight in line. He reached the west end of the building, pausing only long enough to feed the stutter gun a brand new magazine. He leapt the last few feet to the ground and was ready by the front door, waiting for Velasquez's troops. The seven of them never really had a chance. The secondary explosion told Bolin one or more of his grenades had sparked a fire, the hungry flames exploring, looking for a place to feed. He didn't know what kind of merchandise Velasquez had inside the building, and he didn't care. His point was made. Until the next stop. The executioner was only warming up, and he had much to do before the main event. Along the way, he meant to give his enemies a taste of hell on earth. It was the very least that he could do.
Havana, Cuba, 7:15 a.m.
Major Luis Rivera was an early riser by disposition and training. A child of peasant stock, he grew up working in the cane fields from the crack of dawn to sundown, a compulsive regimen that followed him into the military service of his country some years later. These days, when his rank and duties would have normally allowed him to relax a bit, he found himself controlled by force of habit, instinct, call it what you will. He rose near dawn each day, regardless of the season or the work at hand, and rarely went to bed before the stroke of midnight, even on his rare days off. It happened, therefore, that Rivera was on duty, working in his office, when the call from Panama came through. It was his private line, reserved for sensitive communications, theoretically unmonitored by his superiors within the DSE.
Hello?
This is Del Valle. We have a problem.
Explain.
A war of sorts. Our friends are killing one another in the streets.
I believe enforcement of the law is your department.
You have a sizable investment in the operation. I thought that you should be informed.
And what is it that you will have me do?
The colonel thought about it for a moment, taken by surprise. He called sometimes to ask advice, more often to complain about the risk that he was taking in return for getting fabulously rich. But their arrangement was a relatively simple one. Rivera and the Cuban government agreed to underwrite the traffic in Colombian cocaine and share in any profits made in Nassau. If the DSE was needed to facilitate a shipment, calling on its covert sources to resolve occasional emergencies, Rivera was prepared to go the extra mile. But there was clearly nothing he could do about a gang war in the capital of Panama.
I thought you should be told. If it continues, there will be investigations. Should your link to the arrangement be disclosed?
It will not be disclosed. I have your word on that. Unless I am mistaken.
No, of course not. I simply meant...
A revelation of the sort that you suggest would surely point to you as well. And if you somehow manage to escape detection, I would still be forced to re-evaluate our contract.
There
would be diplomatic protests, I imagine. But in the absence of compelling evidence, the president would hardly recognize such blatant propaganda as established fact. We would be forced to cut our losses, as the Yankees say.
There was a momentary silence from Del Valle as he registered the message, taking it to heart. He got the point, but it could do no harm to emphasize.
Remember Salazar?
Of course.
And please, feel free to keep in touch if you have any more concerns.
I will.
Rivera leaned back in his swivel chair. He was concerned about the prospect of disruption to the trade through Panama, since he was banking on that traffic for his own retirement fund. Beyond the personal concern, Rivera's guarantee of safety had persuaded his superiors to let the scheme proceed, and any failure now would place his own neck on the chopping block. He would begin to monitor the situation closely through his eyes in Panama, but he would take no action yet. Direct involvement would be premature, potentially disastrous if the game went sour. He could wait a while before he made his move. And if Del Valle weakened, showed signs of strain, well, there were ways around that problem too. In fact, no matter how the game played out, it might be wise to look for new associations, insurance, as it were. It was always good to be prepared.
And please, feel free to keep in touch if you have any more concerns.
I will. Remember Salazar. As if I could forget. The fool.
Ruben Salazar had been a Cuban operative in Panama, a go-between of sorts when Noriega was in power, handling payoffs, running messages between the presidential palace and the DSE when there were matters that required extreme discretion. He had served for 18 months before he lost his mind and thought that he could play both ends against the middle, holding up his masters with a threat of airing their dirty secrets, scuttling the Panamanian connection with America if he revealed the Cuban bond. It was a gamble, and the agent lost. Rivera had no tolerance for fools, and he reserved a special hatred for the kind of traitor who would sell out his country for private gain. Not that the major's communistic principles prevented him from banking money on the side by any means, but he demanded loyalty from his troops at any cost. When Salazar went missing on a Friday night, Del Valle knew he was as good as dead. The shock had come when he surfaced 3 days later, bound with barbed wire to a telephone pole on the outskirts of Fort Clayton, overlooking the canal. According to the medical examiner's report, he had been tortured brutally, nonstop, for most of the 3 days that he was missing. Shock and blood loss had eventually spared him further agony, and he was then discarded as a public warning to Rivera's other agents in the field. Betrayal had a price, and there was no escape. Del Valle thought it had been an error to involve Rivera in his current problem, but the news was bound to reach him either way. At least in this scenario, Del Valle demonstrated loyalty, full disclosure of the facts, before Rivera heard the story from his spotters on the street. And if the Cuban was uncomfortable with the night's events, so much the better. He might actually be moved to help Del Valle for a change, instead of simply waiting for his bonus payments to arrive. Or did he really want the Cuban's help? It crossed Del Valle's mind that DSE involvement meant a loss of personal control, intrusion by a band of foreigners who took their orders solely from Havana. Intervention by the Cubans placed another wild card in the deck when he was faced with two rogue players as it was. Barbosa and Velasquez had to be controlled, and that would mean involving Santiago. Del Valle bit back a curse. Overnight, his neatly ordered world was threatening to fall apart, and at the moment he had no concrete idea of how to put it right. His first attempt, the phone call to Rivera, now appeared to be a grave mistake. His next move, calling Santiago, would be calculated in advance to guarantee the desired result. Santiago enjoyed his privacy, avoiding contact with business associates whenever possible, but this qualified as an emergency in Del Valle's mind. Barbosa and Velazquez were on the verge of open war if they hadn't already crossed the line. Both purchased their supplies from Santiago, and he had to understand how much a shooting war, with the resultant heat of an investigation, stood to jeopardize his safety. No one was untouchable these days if thrown into the eye of publicity. Guillermo Santiago had a reputation for resolving problems, and Del Valle hoped he'd agree to intervene between Barbosa and Velazquez, making them understand that all this killing would be bad for business. If they refused to listen, one or both of them would have to die. It was a drastic step, but as the bodies started piling up, there would be public calls for justice, restoration of the peace. Arresting either of the dealers and subjecting him to trial would be like opening Pandora's box. Who could predict what either man might say if he was called to testify? The payoffs he had made to ranking members of the government since Noriega's fall, the links with Santiago in Colombia and other friends in the Bahamas, moving drugs to the United States. It would be scandalous, disaster for them all. Of course, such felons had been known to struggle and resist arrest. In that case, no one would be startled if a gun went off and blood was shed. The officer who pulled the trigger would become a hero, earn promotion. The dealer who replaced Barbosa or Velazquez, maybe both, would learn from their mistakes and make an effort to avoid embarrassing his friends. Del Valle was beginning to enjoy the fantasy, but logic told him he should strive for a more peaceable solution first. Barbosa and Velazquez paid their bribes on time, and they had caused no major problems up until the last few hours. It was premature to think of killing either man before they had a chance to talk. But he would speak to Santiago first, a point of courtesy or protocol, and personal insurance, just in case things went from bad to worse. Besides, Del Valle liked to share his troubles. It was so much nicer than attempting to discover the solutions on his own. And if he failed by any chance, there would be blame enough to go around.
Chicorodó, Colombia, 8:30 a.m.
The swimming pool was lined with tile imported from Venice, hand-painted with erotic scenes that would have made the Kama Sutra's author stop and stare. Below the surface of the water, they were magnified, distorted slightly, so the figures almost seemed to come alive. Guillermo Santiago liked to dive and hold his breath, imagining the several thousand figures come to life, all coupling frantically around him as he watched. Sometimes it made him so excited that he had to call for one of his women and possess her right there in the pool. It was a privilege that came from owning money, land, and people. His father had worked on a coffee plantation near Bello, north of Medellin, but they were caught up in La Violencia, Guillermo's parents and two older brothers killed by left-wing guerrillas in a Sunday raid on the village. Or had they been right-wing guerrillas? It was hard to remember after 26 years, and Santiago had only been 14 at the time. Still, he was old enough to remember faces glimpsed from his hiding place in the forest, along with the names their attackers had called back and forth to one another while they killed the men and boys, dragging some of the younger women and girls away for their pleasure. It took Guillermo Santiago 19 months to find them all and kill each one in turn. Before he finished, he was almost 17, and he had earned a reputation as a ruthless killer. In the neighborhood of Medellin, that background either got you work or got you killed. Santiago took the work. For 7 years, he executed contracts for the cartel, collecting information all the while and memorizing the mistakes his masters made so that he could avoid them in the future. By the time he was 25 years old, Guillermo Santiago had a nest egg that allowed him to acquire a shipment of cocaine. He also had the necessary skill and nerve to smuggle it through the Dominican Republic to Miami, where he tripled his money. That shipment led to another and another, until he had a different sort of reputation. Now he was a ruthless killer with a growing fortune on his hands, and those who wished to deal with Santiago didn't snap their fingers anymore. They showed respect, which is to say, they were afraid. Respect and fear were flip sides of the coin in Santiago's business. You couldn't have one without the other when you dealt with jackals every day. A show of weakness on the smallest matter was enough to get you killed, and there were always several dozen would-be leaders waiting in the wings to take your place. So far, pretenders to the throne had had no luck with Santiago. When the leader of the Medellin cartel got jealous and dispatched assassins to his rancho in the north, Guillermo sent the genitals of his attackers home in plastic sandwich bags. When the guerrillas pressured Santiago for extortion money, he invested in a pair of military helicopters, tracked them to their village, and destroyed them in the middle of the night together with their families. It was the only way he knew to play the game. Clinging to a ladder in the deep end of the pool, he saw one of his servants approaching with a cordless telephone in hand. Guillermo frowned. In his experience, the unexpected calls were mostly trouble, seldom news that anyone would want to hear. Still, trouble was a part of power, and its resolution was the final test. He scrambled halfway up the ladder, heedless of the fact that he was naked. As Santiago found a towel, the servant placed the phone on a nearby table and left. The drug dealer didn't ask the naked woman on the chaise by the pool to leave. The headphones covering her ears would give him ample privacy, and Santiago liked the view.
Colonel De Valle.
I must apologize for calling you at home, Guillermo.
Never mind.
We have a problem here.
Go on.
Our friends are quarreling. There are casualties.
How many?
17 so far. More wounded, I suspect.
The cause?
It's difficult to say. The trouble started overnight. I have not spoken with them yet.
But you are calling me.
I thought you should know in case I cannot reason with them. If I must take steps...
Of course. I'll see what I can do. Meanwhile, if there are any further difficulties, use your own initiative.
I will.
Guillermo frowned. Barbosa and Velazquez were subordinates, but they weren't his men per se. Both dealers came to him for their merchandise, and so he exercised a fair amount of influence, but they could always turn to Medellin or Cali if they didn't like his rules. At least, they thought so, anyway. In fact, Guillermo Santiago rarely let a customer escape. He was a reasonable man where business was concerned and did his best to look out for the interests of his customers. When they betrayed him, though, or jeopardized his safety, there was hell to pay. He wouldn't judge Barbosa or Velazquez on the basis of a phone call from Del Valle, but it was enough to make him seek more information on his own. A shooting war in Panama was bad for business, worse than all the killing that went on in Medellin and Bogota. At home, the violence was accepted as a fact of life, a means of helping nature weed out her defective specimens. In other countries, where the Yankees had expressed an interest, random bloodshed in the streets could bring on punitive reactions that were bad for all concerned. Guillermo meant to find out what was going on and solve the problem for the benefit of all concerned, but mostly for himself. He didn't like intrusions on his quiet life at home, and he would punish those responsible. Beginning now.
Panama City, 9:05 a.m.
The crowd had started turning out by 8 o'clock, responding to the flyer circulated over several days. Miranda had been hoping for a group of 6 or even 7,000 people, but she estimated nearly twice that many in the ranks when they began their march downtown. The organizers soon ran out of placards, but a number of the demonstrators brought their own. It was Democracy in Action's largest protest demonstration in the past 3 months, and she could see that they were gaining bodies all the time, new marchers falling into line with every block they traveled. Traffic snarled on side streets, blocked by the procession, and police were out in force to keep the peace. So far, they hadn't tried to stop the march, but she expected opposition well before they reached the presidential palace. And from that point on, it would get interesting. Miranda marched along and enjoyed the atmosphere, but she couldn't help thinking of the tall American and the explosive violence he had triggered overnight. If there were fewer police along the line of marchers than usual, it was because their officers had called them off to pick up bodies, scouring the urban battleground for evidence. Miranda, near the middle of the crush, jumped up on tiptoe long enough to see the armored cars approaching two abreast. With just a glimpse, she recognized the AMAC vehicles that had been purchased from America, their windows screened with heavy wire. Each car would have a dozen riot officers inside, but they were weapons in themselves, equipped with ramming bumpers, water cannon and grenade launchers, water cascade pipes to keep the sides slippery and douse petrol bombs, electrical wires in the hull to shock any unwelcome hangers-on. Behind the vehicle, she saw a line of riot clubs and helmets steadily advancing, easily 100 officers. They were still nearly half a mile from the presidential palace, and the gauntlet had been thrown. Rocks began to fly. In a public demonstration, when troops arrived, you started throwing rocks. It was the thing to do. And when the rocks got a little too close, the water cannon opened up. Marchers were swept off their feet by the pounding torrent, their clothes tattered by the force of the onslaught. The vehicles advanced, and Miranda was jostled by the crowd as it began to break and turn. Another moment, and pale clouds of nauseating pepper gas erupted around them. Miranda started pushing through the crowd, not running from the vehicle so much as making for the sidewalk, knowing she could easily be trampled if she tried to stand fast in the middle of the street. She found the recessed doorway of a shop, stayed long enough to catch her breath, then plunged back into the frenetic, churning crowd. There was an alley up ahead, perhaps an exit from the riot scene if she could get that far. The hot tears in her eyes weren't entirely due to CS gas. What kind of government preferred to gas its people rather than sit down and listen to their justified complaints? How could she champion nonviolence when the state replied to every peaceful protest with a show of force? The riot troops were charging now. Men fell and blood spilled from open wounds. Behind the tinted plastic shields, the troops' faces were invisible. She ran, half blinded by the gas now, almost to the alley. Miranda turned to see who had pushed her and was greeted by a raised club. It was 2 feet long at least, black plastic gleaming with a bright steel knob at either end. It was drawn back, prepared to strike. A man came out of nowhere, stepping past her and delivering a swift kick to the soldier's groin. The riot stick went flying, clattering on the pavement. Her attacker clutched himself and went down to his knees. The stranger turned to face Miranda, one hand reaching out for hers.
Time to go.